Hello, everyone. We are continuing on with Thomas Manton's A Treatise of Self-Denial. And last time we were continuing on with denying our self-love, and it was under the point of our denying our interests and enjoyments. And last time we did how to identify it and what are its acts, what shows that it reigns in our lives, and then some remedies in that self-love. So what are its acts? How do we know it's reigning in our lives and our state and condition with that, and then some remedies. And that brought us up to what he's calling the fourth branch, which is self-seeking. And Lord willing, that's what we're going to continue with for this reading. And I'll go ahead and begin. Again, he says, the fourth branch is against self-seeking, by which I mean a denial of our own ends or purposes, for God must be the utmost end of all the creature's actings. Here I shall show, number one, what this self-seeking is. Number two, the evidences how it bewrays itself. Number three, how necessary it is to handle it. Number four, how difficult it is to deny this part of self. And number five, some remedies by way of consideration and practice. First, what it is. Self-seeking is a sin by which men refer all they do or can do to their own glory and advancement. There is a double self-seeking, contrary to the double end of the creature's being and operation, one by which we aim at our own profit, P-R-O-F-I-T, and another by which we aim at our own glory. For the two great ends of the creature's being are that we may enjoy God, and then that we may glorify God. Those are the creature's two purposes. Number one, our great aim should be to enjoy God. That is the business to which we are poised and inclined by the bent of nature. An immortal soul was made for an eternal good. Nothing beneath God will satisfy it, and the heaven that we expect is nothing else but the filling up of the soul with God. There is a great controversy in the world between God and self while we are here, but now in heaven the quarrel is taken up, and we and God are united in the nearest and closest way of union and communion that we may enjoy Him forever. Now when we rest in any low enjoyment and are satisfied with it without God, that is self-seeking. In effect, it is self-destroying and self-losing. But the scripture speaks according to our aim and intention. We intend to seek ourselves, though in effect, we do but lose ourselves. Of this, the scripture speaks, all seek their own and not that which is Jesus Christ's. In effect, neither their own nor Christ's, but the carnal and corrupt heart of a man counts nothing our own things, but the concernments of the flesh. Of this kind of self-seeking, they are guilty that do God's work, but not with God's ends or purposes, not to enjoy Him, but to enjoy the world. They make a mere merchandise of obedience. If they have worldly gain, they are satisfied. For other things, they will give God a bill of discharge. Matthew 6, verse 12, they have their reward. They will acquit and release God of all the grant and promise that He has made of heaven to them in the covenant of grace, if God will give them a patent to enjoy as much of the world as they can, which argues a sordid and base spirit. Very low. Romans 16, verse 18, they are such as serve not our Lord Jesus Christ, but their own belly, and by good words and fair speeches deceive the hearts of the simple. The apostle speaks of false teachers that did not make God their end, but were wholly or fully bent upon their own secular profit, again, P-R-O-F-I-T, that reprove not for, but soothe men up in their sin. In their preaching, there is no salt, and in their private visits, there is a great deal of worldly compliance, and all because they have set up another god, such a base thing as the belly instead of Christ. Then number two, so that was our great aim. First great aim is to enjoy God. Number two, the next aim of the creature should be to glorify God in all the motions and operations of the soul. This must be the settled frame and constitution of souls to enjoy God, and that is our happiness, and to glorify God, that is our work. And therefore, when the aim of the heart is at our own glory and praise, this is self-seeking. Now, that you may discern it the better and see when the soul is guilty of it, I shall show you how far we are to intend the glory of God in every action of ours. I shall do it in these propositions. Number one, this must be the end or purpose that we must propose to ourselves in all our civil actions. Though the action be civil, yet the end must be religious, that I may glorify God and do good to others. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 31, though it be but in such a natural action as eating and drinking. This must be the fixed aim, to do all to the glory of God. Otherwise, you set up another God, Moloch, instead of God, Jehovah God. When merely you eat to gratify your own flesh, it may be a meat offering and drink offering to appetite. And so also for your traffic, and I believe that means like your business, how you handle your affairs of your business. If it be merely for wealth, it is but consecrating yourselves to mammon and setting the world in the place of God. This is the great mercy of God that, considering our necessity, he has so wisely ordered it that he might lose no part of our time. Our very natural actions may be religious. Works of nature may become acts of grace, and our traffic or business may be a kind of worship when our ends or purposes are to glorify him. Otherwise, we set up self in his place. Your very eating is idolatry when it is merely to please and gratify self. Your table, it is a table of devils, whose God is the belly, Philippians 3, verse 18. And then, as for your traffic, when you trade in the world merely to grow rich and have not an aim at the glory and service of God, you set up another God. Mammon is your God, Matthew 6, verse 24. No man can serve two masters. Ye cannot serve God and mammon. But here arises a question worthy to be discussed, whether in every action we are bound actually to intend God's glory. I answer, we should labor as much as we can to make our thoughts actual. This is the very vitality and vigor of the spiritual life, when all our natural actions are raised up to a supernatural intention. As a Christian is not to have evil aims, so he is not to be like a blind archer to shoot at random and without a mark or a target. Why should we forget God at any time that does always remember us? He always remembers us. So why should we forget God at any time? There is not a moment that passes, but God looks after you, or else you could not live. Nay, he does remember us as if he had forgotten all others and had none else to care for in the world. There is not a good thought of yours forgotten. The spiritual life seems to be as asleep when we do not think of God. In gratitude, we seem to be obliged. And consider again, certainly an actual elevation of the soul is of no great labor and trouble, because thoughts are quick and sudden, and it will not hinder us or be a burden to us to look up with the eye of our soul. But it would be of great profit, again profit, it would make the actions of the mind more acceptable to God, and the soul will the better be kept upright. This will be as a golden crown upon the head of every action, and will be an excellent means to prevent carnal injections. However, because of our infirmities in the lesser actions of life, the habitual intention suffices. As an arrow may fly to the mark, though the archer has ceased to think of it, or rather, as a man traveling homeward may not always think of home, yet he is journeying there. So a Christian may not always actually think of heaven, yet his heart is set that way. Although he did say it's a good practice to try and think of God all the time. We should at least renew this every morning. And in the noble actions of life that require more labor and difficulty, there our thoughts should be explicit. And the reason is because Satan is ready to blast every serious duty with the injection of carnal thoughts. The devil is not only with you in the shop, but in the closet and at duty, so when you, like in your closet prayer. And many times, though we begin in the spirit, yet we are apt to end in the flesh. Self recoils upon us, Genesis chapter 15. Abraham, when he had quartered the sacrifices, the fowls came down, but he drove them away. So when we think of offering duty to God, carnal thoughts are apt to rush into the mind, so that without this actual intention, we may easily begin for God and yet end for self-interest notwithstanding. Number two, in actions sacred and in the higher operations of the soul, be they either internal or external, the utmost end must be the glory of God. Number one, in internal actions, in desires of grace and salvation, our end or purpose must not be self. Our motions are then regular when they are conformed to God, when we have the same end and aim as God has. Now, whatsoever God does, both within and without, in creation and grace, it is for himself. Proverbs 16, verse 4, the Lord hath made all things for himself. Well, then, we should seek grace and glory with the same aim that God gives it. Ephesians 1, verse 6, he hath accepted us in the beloved to the praise of the glory of his grace. That is God's aim, that grace may be glorified in your salvation and in your acceptance of Jesus Christ. So in a way, our salvation in and of itself is secondary to God glorifying himself and his graces and his Son. I desire my salvation, but I should not rest there. But this should be my utmost aim, that God may be glorified in my salvation. Some make a question whether or not we may look to the reward, but those that make that question seem to mistake heaven, and they have a carnal notion of the reward of the gospel, and dream of the heaven of the Al-Quran, and not the heaven of the gospel. And I believe Al-Quran is probably the Quran. So they dream of that kind of heaven and not the heaven of the gospel. What is the heaven of the gospel but to enjoy God forever in the way of a blessed and holy communion? Now, can any man be so irrational to conceive I should not aim at the inheritance of the saints in light as well as the vision and fruition of God? This must needs be a high act of grace to seek my own happiness in the highest way of communion with God. They mistake the nature of the covenant or the way with which God would deal with men, for God has invested his precept with a promise, and men would seem wiser than God. We may use the Spirit's motives, the Holy Spirit's motives, without sin, as the saints have done. It was a foolish modesty in Ahaz when God bade him ask, and he would not ask a sign, Isaiah 7, verses 10 through 12. So it is a foolish modesty when men will not act their faith upon the reward and the blessed recompenses. Christ used this way, Hebrews 12, verse 2. It is said, for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross and despised the shame, etc. And truly, all creatures, as they are now made, must needs take this course, look to the glory that they may discharge the duty and endure the cross. No created agent can rest merely in the beauty and goodness of his own action. It is a folly to say that virtue is a reward to itself if you speak of eternal reward. It is God's covenant way. We are not only to regard duty, but the encouragement of duty. But then the reward must not be the chief cause, but the encouragement, the ultimate reason, must be the glory of God. When we make the reward the ultimate end of all we desire, this is to respect self above God. The glory of God must be the mainspring of all our desires and hopes. To look after happiness is an innocent aim of nature, but to glorify God is the aim of grace. Now, only to aim at happiness is the mere motion of nature and of our own will, but it is our duty to have a further aim at the glory of God. By the law of our creation, we are bound to aim at the glory of God, though our happiness were not subordinate to it, even if it wasn't, for God made all things for himself. That was internal actions. Number two, in external actions and in duties of worship, we must have a good aim. It is dangerous in sacred things to look asquint and by the temple to serve the concernments of the shop. This is to put dung in God's own cup. This is to make God serve with our iniquities and to use worship as a pretense and cover to interest, our own interest. When we pervert things from their proper use, we do them an injury. If a cup were made for a king to drink in, and we should use it as a vessel to keep dung and excrements, it were a high affront to that king. Yet nature does not design such things to such a use, but art and the will of man does, I believe. Duty is made for the special honor of God by his appointment, and therefore it should have no end beneath itself. So the first point was in civil actions. The point two was in sacred actions. Point three, in all conditions of life, a Christian should be indifferent to every estate so God may be glorified. To be like a die cast in the hand of God, let providence cast him high or low as it pleases God. Philippians 1 verse 21. So be it that Christ may be magnified in my body, whether it be by life or death. I am indifferent. My aim only is to magnify Christ. This is the temper of a Christian. Things may fall out, not as we think, but always as we would, if our general aim is to God's glory, for in providence we are required only to be passive. There is nothing left to our choice. We are to resign up our wills to his good pleasure. Our duty is submission. Events must be left to God himself, and in these things he will provide for his own glory. Well then, whether your condition be prosperous or adverse, pleasing or displeasing, if it be for God's glory, it should be all one to you, or all the same. A traveler, when he asks the way, it is all one to him if you direct him to the right hand or the left, so he may accomplish his journey, as long as he does. So it is to a Christian, whether his way to heaven lies by sickness or health, or quiet or trouble, by living at home or by exile and banishment, abased or abounding, by estate or poverty, a Christian is content so God may be glorified. And thus should we, in all conditions of life, submit ourselves to the disposal of God that he might be glorified upon us. Some dispute whether we are not to be at such a pass for the eternal state of our souls, and whether he will damn us or save us, so he may be glorified. So some ask the question following that, well, does it matter? Should we even be concerned if we're saved or not? And Mr. Manton says, I answer, no, we shouldn't be indifferent. This seems to be extremely harsh, and God does not put us upon that trial, the laying down our souls to the disposal of God. That is only required of Christ, that he should lay down his soul as to the consolations of the Godhead for a while. It would put a creature into an indifferency in point of duty, or into despair in point of hope. Whereas God in his covenant seeks to draw on the creatures to be earnest for the everlasting welfare of their souls rather than leave it at his disposal. Even though we are at his disposal, even our souls, he doesn't require us to be indifferent about it and not care. We are drawn to care and seek him for the welfare of our souls. Now, by this you may see what is self-seeking. We do not make it our aim to enjoy God and glorify him in this manner. All right, that was the first part, what self-seeking is. Secondly, to give you the signs by which a self-seeker may be discovered, the best judge is his own conscience, yet to revive guilt by a note or two. Number one, a man is guilty of this self-seeking when he puts himself upon the profession of godliness out of the promise of some worldly advantage. Genesis 34, verses 22 through 24, observe the argument of the Shechemites. They would yield to circumcision upon this supposition: shall not all their cattle and all that they have be ours? A brutish argument. And yet this is very usual, especially in times of public changes. It is usual for men to follow a dying church for a legacy, as vultures for a carcass. The change may be good, but their end is stark naught or nothing. It was a complaint made, there may be a great idol in their own hearts. Men may follow Christ for the loaves, John 6, verse 26. They did not value his person, but they would live at ease and be fed with miracle. Seldom is Jesus valued for his own sake. Men seek temporal conveniences in the practice and profession of the gospel, ease, peace, wealth, credit, and so they appropriate Jesus Christ to secular uses. It was an inestimable mercy that God should send his Son, yet they look no further than the loaves. Number two, when a man cannot endure to be crossed for his religion. Carnal professors are enemies to Christ's cross. Philippians 3, verse 18, their lamp will not burn unless it be fed with the oil of praise and profit, P-R-O-F-I-T. A godly man is contented to be neglected and abased for Christ, and yet still is satisfied with his work. 2 Samuel 2, verse 22, I will be yet more vile. Blessed be God, I can suffer this for his sake. A horse that has a nail in his foot may travel well upon soft ground, but in a hard and gravelly way there he halts. So men, as long as religion is accompanied with conveniency, then they may like it, but are enemies to the cross of Christ, then hirelings will soon prove changelings. Job 2, verse 9, dost thou yet retain thine integrity? When men are delicate and tender and cannot endure the cross, it is a sign they had other aims of credit and profit in their profession. Number three, by envying others in the same profession, we should rejoice in their gifts and graces and be glad that God may be honored by others as well as ourselves. But proud men would shine alone that envy the gifts and graces of others. This is a sure note of self-seeking. It is not grace they look after, but carnal advantage. This is the practice of the elder brother, which Christ taxes in the 15th chapter of Luke. He that is truly gracious desires that others may partake of the same grace, for he knows that God is thereby the more glorified. But when we are covetous of reputation and design our own honor, then the fewer, the greater is our advantage. These men know that their stream will suffer some loss when it is diffused into so many channels. It is notable that of the apostle in Galatians 5, verse 26, let us not be desirous of vainglory, envying one another, provoking one another. Self-seeking puts men upon passions and envy. They are touchy because they are jealous of their own interest, and they are envious because they think the commonness of gifts and graces detracts from their esteem. All right, that was the second point, to give some signs by which a self-seeker may be discovered. Thirdly, to show you how necessary it is that you should practice and that we should preach this part of self-denial. How necessary it is appears enough already, but yet further, it may be added that you should regard it. You should regard this and this part of self-denial. Number one, partly that you may not rob God of his essential honor. There is nothing that alienates a man from God so much as self-seeking. Devotion and service are preserved when we make God our paymaster. But when men look to the world and the approbation of men, they do not care for God. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. 1 John 2, verse 16. Christ is troublesome to such, not welcome, because of the interest he has in conscience. Brethren, it is no small matter I'm speaking about. Self-seeking abuses God exceedingly. It is one of his prerogatives to be the utmost end of the creature's being and operation, and you usurp that which is proper to God. When self has a preeminence above him, God is kept out of the throne. Pharaoh only reserved this to be greater in the throne than Joseph. You may do much that is good, and clothe the naked, and feed the hungry, give your body to be burnt. But all this while, self is greater than God and in the throne. Number two, this is very necessary that you may not rob him of his tribute from the creatures. God has given us many things, only reserved this. My glory will I not give to another. He has given us the prophet, P-R-O-F-I-T, that we may give him the glory. God has given us a lease of the comforts of the world. Only this he has reserved as his rent and acknowledgement that he will be glorified in all our actions and honored in all our blessings. God has made us and has a right and title to us. He that planted the tree has a right in the fruit. God that made us certainly expects some fruit from us. God gave us talents to this purpose, or rather, he lends them to us. We are but servants to employ the talents to our master's use. A Christian has given himself up to God, a living sacrifice, Romans 12, verse 1. You are not your own. God has a right and title to you. Therefore, do not rob him of his glory. A sacrifice under the law was no more his that offered it, but it was the Lord's. And as it is necessary you should practice it, so it is necessary we should press it again and again upon you. Self-seeking is a close evil, as well as a dangerous and heinous one. Two things I observe. Number one, that the greatest self-seeking usually is carried on under the color of self-denial. As the Gibeonites put on old shoes and old garments to make a league with Joshua, so many pretend mortification and self-denial to endear themselves to others for worldly profit and advantage, as those the apostle speaks of in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, that to gain credit, entrance, and applause would take no maintenance. All the carnal designs of men have been carried on under a pretense and veil of religion. Herod, under a pretense of worship, would have Christ to be destroyed, Matthew 2, verse 8. And Jezebel proclaims a fast to destroy Naboth, 1 Kings 21, verse 9. So Simeon and Levi pressed the Shechemites to be circumcised out of revenge. A crocodile weeps and then makes a prey, P-R-E-Y. Carnal ends are often shrouded under religious pretenses. Number two, that we are more apt to accuse others out of envy than to reflect upon ourselves. Many think self-seeking is a sin only incident to them that are called to public employment, either in the church or the commonwealth. We may warn others, but we cannot judge of them, For self-seeking lies in the aim of the spirit, the man's own spirit, and is liable to the censure and judgment of God alone. When the action was fair, Job 1 verse 9, it was Satan's accusation, doth Job serve God for naught or nothing? You should not, out of envy, accuse others, but reflect on your own heart. We may not have such opportunity as they to enrich themselves, and that may put us upon envy. But are not you a self-seeker so far as you can reach within your grasp? Oh, the envy that is in our hearts, and the pride that is in our prayers, and in our conferences, which we do not take notice of. Would you be thought well of in your place, as Simon Magus would be some great one? You may be guilty of simony, as they may be guilty of hypocrisy, bribery, and purloining from the public. Well, that was the third point to show you the necessity of it, or the further necessity. Fourthly, it is a difficult and hard peace, P-I-E-C-E, it's a hard peace of self-denial. It is natural to us. All men seek their own things, Philippians 2, verse 21. All our mark, naturally, is to some aim of our own, at our own profit and credit. It is very hardly laid aside, or in a hard way, for base and unworthy desires are very importunate, or persistent, and do recoil upon us after mortification and after resolutions to the contrary. We often find that we begin well, we aim at the glory of God, it is our habituated aim, but thoughts of pride grow upon us in the very middle of the action or else after it is ended. It is an impudent sin that will assault us again and again. And then fifthly, let me give you some remedies against this sin by way of consideration and practice. Number one, by way of consideration. Subpoint one, self is base and unworthy mark to be aimed at. A base and unworthy mark, yourself is. He that shoots at a shrub will never aim so high as he that shoots at a star. That service must needs be base that does not intend Christ and center in him. All actions savor of the end or purpose. How low-spirited are they that seek themselves? How soon they are apt to warp? It does but expose you to temptation. They that have an ill end will not scruple or argue it at any ill way. He that has a right mark in his eye will hardly miscarry so much as he that takes a wrong mark or target. Number two, consider the greatness of the sin in making other things our end besides God. You use the name of God that you may enjoy the world. You make him a minister of sin. You make religion a bait and Christ a means to accomplish your carnal purposes. It is a question who sins more, he that makes use of wrong means or he that proposes a wrong end. He that makes use of wrong means makes the devil serve God, but he that has a wrong end makes God serve the devil. You make the end serve the means, nay, though it be but in a glance and in a thought, it is a degree of whoredom. God would have Israel to have the law written upon the fringes of their garments, Numbers 15, verse 39, that they might look upon it and remember the commandments of the Lord, and do them, and that you seek not after your own heart in your own eyes, after which you used to go a-whoring. You know the glance of the eye outwardly, and a thought in the heart, it is whoredom. He that looks on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. Evil suggestions that draw us away from God are whoredom. You break the vows of loyal love and affection to Christ. As a man may be an adulterer in thought, so he may be a spiritual adulterer too. James 4, verse 4. Ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that friendship of the world is enmity with God? the devil for one sin of thought, for aspiring after the dignity of God, was turned out of heaven. Now in your own thoughts, you make your own praise your end. Number three, it is an ill sign. To know the end does distinguish a man from a beast, and to choose the end does distinguish man from man. So beasts don't make these kinds of decisions, man does, but then the difference between man and man is what the actual purpose is. Survey all the world, wherever the name of Christian is heard, you will find here is the great difference between man and man in what they make their utmost end and chiefest good. Therefore, when you make self your end, it is an ill character and sign. Number four, no man does less enjoy himself than he that does most seek himself. Self-seeking is always attended with self-losing, for we cannot expect wages from God and mammon too. And worldly rewards are very uncertain. God is wont or often to disappoint carnal aims, and the event is not suitable to the intention. Number five, you shall have the greater judgment. Matthew 23, verse 14. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For ye devour widows' houses for a pretense, and for a pretense make long prayers. Therefore ye shall receive the greater damnation. The Pharisees, that they might be counted great devotionaries, would make long prayers, that they might have the disposing of orphans and be trusted with widows' portions. All sin is out of measure sinful, yours especially. Your very pretense, when you would seem to be good, are stark not or nothing, it aggravates the sin before God. If we would be accounted good when we have an evil aim within ourselves, when we take up religion for an ill purpose and for a cloak only, the sin is the greater, and so will the judgment be also. Number six, consider the dishonor that comes to Christ by self-seeking. There are no greater enemies to the gospel than self-seeking Christians, if that's even possible to be. Philippians 3, verse 18 and 19, for many walk, of whom I have told you often, and now tell you, even weeping, that they are the enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly. None greater enemies than they that make the God their belly, make a God of their belly. What is the reason few or none are now converted, that ordinances are not so powerful as they were often to be or want to be, but because many shroud themselves under the name of Christians and yet mind nothing but their own profit and gain? Testify against them we must, though with grief, that we may keep up the honor and repute of religion that is mightily stained by them. It is an honor to God when we serve Him out of pure love and not for pay or gain. But when men merely make a market of religion, Satan and his instruments make an advantage of this. They will say they profess religion only to get great places. God may have servants enough upon such terms. Job 1 verse 9, doth Job serve God for naught or nothing? It is true, Job is diligent and zealous, but does Job lose by his profession? So carnal men will say, is it for naught or for nothing? They hunt after great places and preferments in the world. It was an old complaint of the Gentiles. Lo, say the heathens, those that talk of their being freed from the tyranny of the devil, that they are dead to the world and alive to Christ, yet we see them to be as base and self-seeking as any. So the heathens were complaining about those who claimed to be Christians, not behaving any better than some of the worst people. In vain do they talk of baptism and the Holy Ghost, by which they think they are ruled in all their actions, and of the gospel. So they talk of the gospel, when their whole life is nothing else but a contradiction to the rules of the gospel. It is a mighty prejudice to religion and a dishonor to God when men shroud themselves under the name of Christian and zealous persons, and secretly aim at their own private commodity and profit. Now, under remedies, that was by way of consideration. And number two, but to remedy this evil by way of practice, be more frequent in prayer and praise. Frequent in prayer, to be purged from all self-seeking and sinister respects. Carnal affection will be importunate, which is persistent. Then for praises, cast the honor upon God himself, as when they would have given the apostles divine honor, they cried out, "We are men of like passions with yourselves, why gaze ye upon us?" So when we meet with applause in the world and are apt to be puffed up, we should cast it back and remember that God is to have this praise. As Joab sent for David that he might have honor in taking the royal city, so should you give God all the glory and praise. Amen. Now he continues, he says, having handled self-denial in reference to God, I shall now speak of it with respect to our neighbor. But we're going to go ahead and stop there for this reading, and then, Lord willing, pick up with that the next time. But until then, go once again seeking from God daily, that we make him our purpose in life, in all things, in all our actions, in all our affairs of life. Trust him fully in all his providences, and ask for help each day and more to be conformed to having in our thoughts, in all our thoughts. And of course, then in our actions, even in our words, and then even more especially down deep in our hearts, that God be all in all, that he get the glory for everything, that we recognize that everything comes from him. And may these things also make us humble, and may he grant that we not be self-seeking. And Lord willing, we will talk to you again soon.